do. It's with a heavy heart you have to hear me prelude to this episode. First time in a long time we've had to do one of these, but there was a ghost in the machine. Some little rat bag, me. I think I pulled out my mic and it fucked up a bit of the recording. So I'm annoyed because I really like this episode and I worked quite hard on it. So no one's more disappointed than you than me. Is that how you say it? No one's more disappointed than I am. And it's all right. I think it was salvageable, hence why you're going to hear it. Fucking hell. Wouldn't put out any old dross. But there are some bits where the audio from my side is a bit snippy and a bit like not fucking creme de la creme. And I was thinking, do we redo it? But we'd lose the authenticity of Jack hearing it for the first time. And I generally don't think. I think the story is still understandable. If for a second you think, oh, what was that word there? I come back and I repeat myself. So it should be all right. I'm just sorry, guys, all right? I'm not fucking perfect. Anyway, how have you been? Yeah, speak to you later, mate. Take you soon. Bye. Welcome to Tales Wales, the pod never fails to add some chivalry to your ears. Put your stones in your bowls and batter you around the head with constant knowledge and banter. And it's the royal rollicking laugh himself, Lord Cadgy upon High.
Hello.
Joined by me, the Right Honourable Lord Bastard Executioner himself, Uncle Daddy. I didn't write my.
I didn't write the rest of it. I was like, I can tell because Uncle Daddy, I thought, was something reserved for just me and the boys. I didn't realize that was bleeding into the podcast world.
Yes. Well, welcome back. You join us for pathos of
Yeah.
I'd love to do that history. The nuggets that are like, you know, slightly more modern or more bizarre or like Welsh mythic stuff for me to guess on. But this was our bread and butter.
Oh, mate, it's what got us. It was our first love, wasn't it? You know, like it's the medieval battles. It's the resistance. It's always whatever gets me going is it's
the resistance lives on.
Viva la resistance.
I watched South Park, the movie, the other day. It was bad.
Wow. I was just like, how does that square up these days?
Well, not. But it has that fun song with you, because La Resistance lives on.
La Resistance lives on.
I get really, you may get caught in a trap, you may get caught in a hole. And it's so like over the top and silly, but I love it.
God, I remember that song. I can't remember any of the words. So the only one I know off by heart, because it's very simple, is Shut Your Fucking Face, Uncle Fucker. You're a bonafide bastard. Also, bonafiding bastard. Is a great slam. I don't care whatever generation from, bona biting bastard is very good.
That's funny. Do we have a Patreon people to read out? I know we've for me and you it's back to back.
We do. We're getting right on the Patreon stuff now. We're back on and doing it consistently because we skipped a few weeks didn't
we just completely stopped.
Just went right. Thanks for the support, but you don't get anything back.
Okay. Well, they got their episodes, so they always got their
episodes.
That's
true. Got the episodes, right? So the next one we got is someone named Charlene Evans, and I was just confused because I know we've had a Charlene before because we used to go Charlene.
We've got a couple of Charlenes already,
but the last one was Charlene Reese. This is Charlene Evans. So I want to give you the same gift we gave Mrs. Reese or Miss Reese. Charlene Evans,
Charlene Reese is a lovely human. So you're in good stead with sharing a similar name to Charlene Reese.
And this is the second episode in a row that we've got an Only Fools and Horses reference.
Oh, Charlene,
you dozy man.
We've been married. Charlene's been happily married for 20 years. I've simply been married.
classic 80s banter right there, yeah.
Yeah. I unapologetically fucking love Only Fools. I think it's
good. I don't care what anyone says. Good. It's very, very good. No. You know my stepdad, yeah. Mel? He's got like his own little man cave. I know you hate that term, but he genuinely does because it's like it's his little shed in the garden. He exits the house to go into this thing, right? And I was in there. He's got an N64.
What, your mum's house?
Yeah, yeah. So my mum's house goes out and there's a shed, right? You go in there. He's got a little telly. He's got a Nintendo 64 plugged up to it with GoldenEye on it. I get drunk and play it with him sometimes. It's fucking really? Brilliant. Yeah, it's so, so good. He's shit at it as well, so I get to batter it, which is brilliant. And then the only other thing he has in there is like one of those little tiny DVD players. And I was like, oh, you just like got loads of films near of you. And I said, yeah. He was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, where are they? Because I couldn't see like stacks of films or DVDs anywhere. And he went, oh, there. And it's literally just the entire box set of Only Fools. And I think he just goes through from like episode one to the end again and again and again.
We had this massive, like, giant. He loved him. His nickname was Bondage. Massive, and I don't, like, we generally didn't.
Wow.
We didn't, like, we never knew his. And we did know it by the end, like people did, but lots of people didn't know. So one night the police arrested some of us, and we had Jimmy, real name's Chris, got that wrong. And I went, yeah, Bondage came out of nowhere. We like, what? My mum was saying, who are you living with next year? And we're like, oh, well, actually, I'm living with Craig, Jimmy, Coxie, Bondage. And I just forgot that that's means something different to other people. But we called him Bondage because we didn't speak to him in first year. You just hear like these growls and grunts coming from his room. And we just think he's always tied up. Great. And he used to leave. We had like a shared shower on our hall block. And he used to leave to go to the shower in like a robe. And I genuinely love.
Like Hugh Hefner.
Okay. Yeah. And he had this. He grew his hair really long, and it looked horrible. We went to the beach once, and he'd never smoked weed. I don't smoke much weed, but he never smoked weed before. It's so clear. He smoked it. You're, oh, that's good shit. It's like he's only seen it in reference in films. And then he went, oh, boys, what's the smoke drive limit? Because he was driving us back. I was like, there is no smoke drive limit. It's illegal.
Smoke drive limit. Brilliant. Trying to
join. But yeah, he was obsessed with Only Fools and Horses, like properly obsessed with it. And he used to be so lazy where he'd just lie down and watch like it on repeat, on repeat, on repeat. But it was during the time when we had DVDs, and one time he watched Napoleon Dynamite, and he was too fucking lazy to get out of bed to turn it off. So he watched it three times back to back because he would just play from the start.
Couldn't
on his,
be
like...
bothered to take it out on the fucking DVD for it. That's,
yeah, so
that's a good film. It's a very good film, but I wouldn't watch it three times in a row. That's mad.
He's the biggest Only Fools fan.
Speaking of strange people in uni, I remember there was a guy in our halls who we referred to as Beardy Dave. Right, he had a beard, spoiler. And basically, it was like the first day everyone was meeting up in the kitchen, right? All our halls, you had like sort of shared kitchens, shared toilets, whatever. I mean, we all meet in the kitchen, everyone's like, you know, shaking hands, saying hello and all that. You're trying to sort of get the measure of everyone. And this Beardy Dave comes in, the measure of the man, and this Beardy Dave comes in, and he seemed nice enough or whatever like that, right? And he went, oh, by the way, he said, oh, my sister's baked a cake for everyone to share, so I'll just, you know, very sweet, whatever, nice, he put it down.
Mad.
Oh, yeah, go on then. I was thinking, like, fucking, what was this guy about? But given the benefit of the doubt, and then what happened is one of the guys there, this guy named Sam, he went, oh, I'll try a bit of your sister's handiwork, and like sort of took a slice of the cake. And Beardy Dave like got up and just left. And I don't think he ever joined in with us with anything ever again. Like, as if that was like that.
That's the one.
I was the straw that broke the camel's back. But in a way, I was thinking, I mean, you probably wouldn't last anyway. If that's the limit of offense you can take, you're probably not going to last long anyway. But
fruit cake to your first day at uni is sweet, but I'd say misjudged.
Yeah, I think gives us strange vibes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If one of my numerous siblings had gone, I've baked you a cake to take in, I'd be like, you keep that shit to yourself. I'm trying to
fucking like
or put like fucking shagger on it or something. Like that. Razor blades, yeah.
to hurt me, you're set like a precedent.
Yeah, exactly.
Big man on campus.
But yeah, so when they bite in and cut their mouths open and need stitches, you go, now you know who's in charge, right?
Now you know, I'm the fucking daddy around here.
Yeah, I've always been a psycho, me, yeah.
Shall I carry on with the next one? Because again, it's a little bit of a longy. The last one was quite a longy.
Go for it, man.
We're going to record a Patreon.
I'll ask you one thing before I go. I need your sound advice. Another beer or a rum? That's the question.
Listen to this. Well, you can't hear anything.
I could hear. I'm assuming is that a little tiny bit of ice left in your drink?
Yeah, there was loads of ice there a minute ago. And I think the noise of ice chinking on a glass is so.
It reminds me of that meme where it goes, name me a sound better than this. Clink, 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 clink. But it's like an iced coffee, I think she's got. And it's like, replace that with rum. And you're on to something. Right, you've twisted my arm. I'm on the lambs.
Like, we haven't done an episode like this in a while where it's like back to things we love a lot. And I feel like really happy today. So and I'm in quite a good spirit. So I'm loving it. I mean,
it's like when I have the rum, it makes me really happy.
But you know, I've had like a lot going on recently, which has been a bit kind of not depressing because I don't really do depression, but I do anxiety. I'm in the bucket load. I feel like quite happy. And me and you going away for my birthday this weekend, aren't we?
We are. It's going to be great.
Where my wife has organised it, and she's the worst kept secret in the world. So she told me instantly, then tried to pull it back.
Yeah, I was trying to keep it shtum from Franks, and then Franks mentioned it on a call one time, and I was like, what do you mean? And he went, no, it's all right. Emma's just let it loose. I'm like, fair enough then.
But I can't wait for us to ruin it by just me and you spending the entire weekend.
Can't wait for us both to go home to our spouses on the Sunday and then go, it could have been a really lovely evening, but you and Jack had to take it too far, / you and Frank, you know, whichever end you're looking at it on.
But then, are you coming to the cinema with me on Monday?
Yes, I got the day off.
We booked it off, legend. Yeah. Oh, does that mean Friday to Sunday night we get back on it again?
Well, to be fair, I'll probably come home and go, look, Amy, I'm off tomorrow. I might as well have a couple of drinks to make me feel better.
So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I'll see you Monday. Oh, that's class, man. So I've had my whole birthday with Jack.
I was just about, when I told Amy about it, she went like, oh, is he not spending his birthday with Emma? And I was like, yes, no.
She's got like no annual leave left. So, I had some to use. So I've got Monday and Tuesday off. So I would never normally take my birthday off. I'm not that kind of guy. But like, I just thought, I might as well. And also, we were debating maybe going away for that. So yeah. But then when I was going to go cinema on my own, thought I'd ask my boy.
Exactly. And here he is. He's just turning up. And I also, I even said, no, and like, oh, if I have the day off, I'll bring a couple of cans to the cinema. We'll make a day of it.
Make a day of it. all right, one second. So, but should we head off over to back in time? I'm so bad at math, but if we're going back now to 1164, that's probably 1,000 years ago, thereabouts.
1164, let's call it that. 1164,
I'm so fucking dyslexic.
1164,
I've actually got that wrong. Because
900 something years ago, 10 years ago. I don't know.
So I'm very, very math literate. Like, I'm very, very, very bad at math and like bad at, what's that cunning word? Dyslexia when it comes to math stuff. And I read Malcolm the Fourth in 1163. So I just said 1164. But when I have to do like math stuff in work, when they're like, oh, how much budget have you got left for this campaign? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I literally, I'll often say, oh, I went to a Welsh school, so I don't know my numbers in English. So can I just send you the number? That's like, fantastic. If we're on a call, I'll write it in the chat. And it always
absolutely
fucking
taking advantage of working in the big smoke of London. Yeah. Right. Listen, in little old Wales, we don't learn the numbers in English. So I'd love to tell you, but you wouldn't understand.
Yeah. You know, if it's like 167, 324.
Yeah.
Like 1164, you know, that's just, it's too, I can do up to 1,000, easy. 12,000, 18,000.
I can count 1,000 out, right? So don't worry about me.
Minute it gets to six digits, I generally crumble. Because I say the first bit, and I'm like, okay, that's 11. Well, it can't be 11 because it's got fucking loads of zeros after it. But anyway, I digress. Let's go back in time. a certain amount
a while
of years. And last week we learned about the early years and then the rise to power of Lord Rhys.
Mm.
And how after many battles with the Normans and the kings of England, Henry II, he and another powerful Welsh ruler, Owain Gwynedd, and Malcolm IV of Scotland, just appeared before Henry at Woodstock to acknowledge his authority and power over them in around 1163. So that's us back up to speed. Mm. Him, so Lord Rhys, our hero, Owain Gwynedd, and Malcolm IV have all come to submit once again to Henry II. To show him, to, you know, they're their leaders in their respective areas, but king on high is Henry II.
Yeah.
But as we know, Lord Rhys was not one for laying down.
Not at all.
And a year later, in 1164, he and other Welsh princes united in an uprising. And in a book written by W.L. Warren about Henry II, he explores that when Rhys and Owain were obliged to do homage in 1163, they were forced to accept the status of dependent vassalage instead of their previous status, which was more worthy of their position. So these like humiliating terms were the worst they'd yet to experience. Yeah. And this was a big key factor in their revolt.
Vassalage then? So I'm assuming before they were like, look, your own kingdom. If you accept our terms, you can run your own fucking whatever it's called, canter something, pay homage, but like you are your own kind of thing. But now it's like a you'll do what I say type thing.
Yeah, a proxy state to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's a you're in charge. So like you'll, if you will do as I say, and you are this kind of proxy leader, the head of it, this puppet government. And as we did on last week's episode, Rhys has spent his entire life fighting to reclaim the lands of his
he was a guy who liked to rebel. Let's just say that.
A scrapper. Mm. And in doing so, for like his entire family had fought to reclaim Wales for the Welsh, especially Deheubarth for the Deheubarthians. But in doing so, nearly all of his family died. His mother, his father, his brothers all died for the cause. Mm. So Rhys had more reason to revolt over the new relationship between him and Henry II, rather than just his humiliating terms, but also, you know, his whole family had died for a reason.
For a generation or two.
But to send things over the edge for Rhys, when he came home to Deheubarth from the meeting in Woodstock, he found the vicious and ruthless Normans had grown bold in his absence, and they were now threatening once again his home in Cantre Mawr. His nephew, Einion ap Annarwy, who had been a captain of his bodyguard, had been murdered at the instigation of Roger de Clare, of Earl of Hereford. Yeah, I know. We'd mentioned the de Clare. It's been these bastards forever. But
one time you're gonna have to do like an episode on like Wales versus de Clare, and how many times the de Clares have like fucking done some shit.
I love that. That's a really good one. Mm-hmm. But Einion was like the head. He was like this really, really well trained soldier. And also we've discussed before like the term tailey, which means like the retinue of like the lordships who were like the best of the best in terms of fighting. But the person who murdered him had been given protection status by the Clares in Ceredigion. So a family member and a really important person in his retinue had been murdered, and he was given protection, so there was no justice. So Rhys first appealed to the king in a favour for peace for his people. He was like, right, come on, I'm doing this the right way
Rhys of like saying he didn't try to go the proper channels every now and then. Do you know what I mean?
He was buzzing when they got nothing.
Dare you just say no to me, bro.
King took matters into his own hand, like he'd done previously.
Rubbing his hands together, going, Ostad, no, is he? Oh, brilliant.
I bet you. He had like a knife to someone's throat, and he texts the king saying, will you help me? All right, he's not replied, stab, and it's all done.
He's double blue ticked me. Right, dead.
He took matters his own hands, and he invaded Ceredigion, striking down the Norman resistance that stood in his way, and he recaptured all of it apart from the town and the castle of Cardigan. So he was like, right, I've gone the right way. I've tried to get peace. You've murdered one of my family, but now fuck you.
Yeah. Lives are off.
And he was fucking ruthless, apparently, in how he gutted the Normans from his land wherever he could. Like, he was decided, right, I'm going back to fucking barbaric nature.
Going scorch earth.
So he was like, yeah, scorch earth, no prisoners, not murdering because it's war, killing as many as he could. And
it's like
giving
me and
no
you in
quarter.
A medieval Total War 2, mate. When we recapture we always try to instill fear in the English. We always slaughter prisoners, we never keep any.
But this guy was built in war, and he grew up in a fighting family, like the fighting Irish. And it was pretty obvious you were never going to tame him with such unfair actions. So he was like, you know, he wouldn't take the chances, and he would just murder.
200 years of oppression, 200 years on the session.
But then his actions and not taking prisoners and this kind of like these people who've been taken and like, you know, battering Wales in wars and in like policy built up such resentment when people hear that this one Welsh guy continuing this fight despite all his family being dead, it led to huge revolts kicking off all across Wales, not just because of him, but a massive part because of him. And eventually he became so pronounced that, and also they were like, shit, if he's doing this and he doesn't care that he's fucking striking them up and he's like for money, he's like, fuck this, I'm going to kill every one of you who fights in the name of King Henry. And similarly to how they portray Wallace in Braveheart, it becomes a war rather than like, it is a war of like
ideas. Lord Rees killed 50 men. 50.
I think it's our favourite film in the world.
So cool.
And eventually this like got such attention that King Henry II of England had to personally get involved again. And this time he was like, right, I'm going to fucking invade. And this is proper now. So he launched a blistering attack in 1165 in Gwynedd. But instead of following his usual invasion routes along the north coast, he attacked from the south, following the routes of Bedouin Hills. However, for once, he was met by a united force of Welsh princes led by Owen Gwynedd and Lord Rees. Which avid listeners to the pod, they'll know the Welsh weren't great at club together, and fighting under one banner for a united cause never happened. However, according to Annalistic Chronicle that logged the important moments of Welsh history, in it says King Henry gathered an innumerable host of selected warriors, and against him Owen Gwynedd and Cadwallader, the sons of Griffith, and all the hosts of Gwynedd, and Lord Rees ap Griffith, and the host of with all the hosts of Deheubarth, and Yodwyth, the red son of Maredith, and the sons of Madoc Maredith, and the hosts of Powys. So all these massive kingdoms were like ready, were like, fuck you, we are here together. And we have discussed this moment in history before, because it happened, because we've mentioned some of the other people, and we've discussed Owain Griffith, but we've actually covered this in previous episodes. But this is just, it's just such a monumental moment in Welsh history.
There's not more context now as well, isn't it, when we're doing it from Lord Rees's perspective as well, when all the positions players in position type thing.
But madly, had this been a pitch, that might have been right, we lost and now it's completely over. All the biggest players in Wales are dead, or they could have killed the enemy and survived, and then Wales could be something completely different. So this was like pivotal. However, we never really got to see the outcome between this Wales v England pitch battle, as there was torrential rain, like really, really, really bad rain. Shock. That forced Henry's army to retreat in disorder. Well, more so than even normal Welsh rain. Mm. Like, you know, we are, you know, I think you said to me before, it rains 5 out of every 7 days in Wales.
Yeah. We were still there going, but Lord Rees was there with his top off, still going, come on then.
You adopted the rain. We are born into it.
Yeah.
So they retreated with only skirmishes happening, with the Welsh chasing the English out with no major battle. But we mentioned that Henry was so, in previous episodes, that Henry was so furious that he took all of his men in England and in France and stuff like that. And he couldn't do what he set out to do, which cost fucking loads. If people aren't aware, when you do these things, you often take important people from either side, usually sons. You take the sons as a show of good faith to be like, right, we'll go to war. And when we come to terms, we'll have a discussion, and to make sure that, you know, we don't trick you. You have some of our men, we have some of yours. So if we could like quickly attack you, you could just kill our hostages, which would be, and they have to be people of high status. So, you know, say if Jack had gone to war with me, I could take Jack's brother. So if Jack was to do something sly, I could, you know, it's
there's always that threat to go in. You can't do something too crazy because,
which sounds mad, but there are rules of war. Like there is an
actual, and those hostages, they're not like chucked in a fucking barn with shackles. No. They're looked after like nobility, aren't they? You know, but you just got to live in a different country,
especially
a different
the Normans. Massive the culture about like what you, how people should act. So one of the reasons why Welsh was so disgusted that his Lord Rees's mother was killed was because she was taken as a prisoner by the end and then beheaded, which was so anti what people were used to. Mm-hmm. But in this anger that Henry II was so pissed off that he couldn't fight them properly and he couldn't manage, he was made to look a bit of a fool because he took everything there and couldn't fight. He vented all this anger out on the hostages. So Meredith got his eyes cut out by Henry II. And then he also went through most of the Welsh churches, burning them, and did nothing but drive this anti-English sentiment all over Wales. So he burnt down and killed loads of the monks. Because also he hated Welsh churches.
I was about to say, this, you know, surely by this point, you must know the kind of man he's dealing with in Lord Rees, and going, yeah. I know what, I'll blind his son and burn loads of Welsh church down, as if he's going Lord Rees will go, yeah, you know what, I'll back down now. That surely is just, this guy's a scrap lover. Like, that's going to send him on, surely.
Do nothing to do it. But it did hurt him because it's still his son.
Of course.
Yeah. And burning down these Welsh churches, because if you keep a religion is such a powerful tool, and you keep a Welsh church going with the Welsh language, it stops you being an English church or being controlled by the English.
Well, it says I read the other day, sorry to interrupt you again, man, I don't keep cutting across.
No, 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 it's kind of like this is dialogue.
It's like the Celtic cross, right, is a thing that, you know, when you look at Celtic imagery, Celtic cross comes up. That's actually not so much Celtic, that's like Celtic Christianity, which is something that's developed from, like, the Celtic tribes that converted eventually to Christianity. I think that, but that is separate almost, you know what I mean? You get a lot of Celtic crosses in the previous Celtic lands, in sort of mainland England, stuff like that. They're just crosses. Because it's almost like our own stamp on the religion, if you know what I mean. So like what you're saying there is that you keep that slightly different religion, even if it's just a branch off, it does so much for that country or that sort of national identity.
Well, the fact that Wales always kept that, more than Scotland and Ireland, is why we have a Welsh language. Because they did let Wales keep its churches after 1282, and the Welsh language thrived in churches. It meant that so... And it was seen as being slightly like, you know, all right, it's a church, it's not an army, so we won't have as big an issue with it. So later, you know, 100 years later after this, when Edward I took over, Welsh churches continued, and then so the language continued, and the impact they had. And so we kept the Church of Wales, which is like
a little a through line that we had all the way from back in the Celtic times that has kept it alive to today,
So Lord Rees returned to Haybarth. They survived. You know, England didn't conquer Wales at this point, and they managed to hold off this army. Rain happened, blah, blah, blah. So he went back to Haybarth with quite a strong army, and he captured on the way home, he burnt Cardigan Castle.
The one I didn't have in the collection, I got to get that one on my way home. Yeah.
So another castle. This guy has literally sacked more castles than I've had McDonald's, and I've had a lot of McDonald's. And then he quickly rallied more troops, and he took another castle, this time Kilgerran Castle. And he was such a battle-hardened leader at this point that men would just flock to fight for him. Yeah. And like his nomadic mother and father used to do, he wouldn't really stay long enough in one place to be pinned down. Like I said, he wouldn't always capture these castles with the idea of manning them. He'd just take them over, besiege them. Lots of them are wooden, so he could burn the castles down. There wasn't a huge amount of stone castles in Wales. So he just burn down these castles, these fortresses, not stay behind, and then just go. But it was Lord Rees who brought in this famous Welsh proverb, which me and you know really well. It's easy to be brave behind the castle walls. So anyone who played medieval Total War, it was a historical real-time strategy game where you play as these, like, Scotland, England, Wales, attack places. And when the loading screens would give you these, like, quotes, like a quote from William Wallace or a quote from Henry II and all these things. And in this one, it just says Welsh proverb. It's easy to be brave behind castle walls, because the Welsh didn't really do castles a huge amount. We had wooden castles, but our tactics were often attack, you know, aggression. And he believed in the best defense with a strong offense. So he always said to his men, it's easy to be brave behind those walls, but wait till we fucking get there. That's when they shit themselves.
Yeah.
And he would just purge the enemy from his lands. And he was so good at attacking these castles because he burned them down so quickly. They could never rebuild a massively strong strength.
Yeah, because I imagine even the wooden ones, they take probably months and months to even set
and
build.
To get back
sort of thing. Yeah, you got to think about it. You got to, like, when it's burnt down, you got to clear what was there before.
Yeah,
and then by the time you've done that, by the sound of things, fucking old Lord Rhys was on his way back from whatever battle he was. Yeah. Oh, God,
and also he'd attack, you know, you could picture him attacking those, cutting down the trees to build up the spikes, to build up the walls and all this stuff. And you're right, so they don't actually end up killing townsfolk because you're just fucking killing the castle, the soldiers in the castle. Mm. So in 1167, he joined up with Owain Gwynedd again in an attack on Owain Cyfeiliog. We mentioned before that, like, the Welsh attacking him, because Powys would often side with the English. But that makes him sound,
it's because it's so close to the border, isn't it? It's like...
But not even that. It's also because he's also getting attacked from the north and the west. So it's like, well, actually, in his mind, Powys is his country.
Yes.
And so if he could join with an ally who wants to fight...
It joins back, doesn't it, to that thing we were saying of... He wasn't thinking, I'm Welsh and they're Welsh. He was thinking, I'm Powysian, I'm Powys, you know.
Yeah.
So we go, if I'm getting attacked from the fucking south or the north up in Gwynedd or whatever like that, he'd go, right, if Mercia are next to me or whoever throughout the ages, the Normans, whoever, are going to side with me for whatever game, why not take their help?
You said a good idea for an episode a minute ago, and it was when we do the declares. Owain Cyfeiliog seems a really interesting character because he joined forces with Owain Gwynedd and Lord Rhys and the other Welsh princes against this English invasion that I mentioned earlier. You know, when I said, like, Henry was coming over. But then he turned on the Welsh and went back to supporting the English. Interestingly, he was like this really notable poet, and he was considered actually one of the best at the time. So he was this great poem that survived called Hiddlas Owain, and it focused on a raid, him and his tailie, or in English, his royal guard, where they went to break his brother Meirig from a prison. And at the end of it, they all drink from these horns. And he has a stanza or two for every single soldier who fought with him. And then, like, he pays like an homage to the two blokes who came with him, who died.
That's like Gododdin, that is. In the Gododdin, it's like the oldest Welsh poem. It's like every single warrior that went to the Battle of Catraith.
You've done that. Is that the episode you did about...
I touched on it briefly. It was like, it was about Arthur, King Arthur, I think.
One of the earliest mentions
of him. I know we've been planning for ages to do like another Gododdin episode to like really go into
But... You should check that episode out. Jack did it where you cover some of the ones where it mentions him.
I think it's a King Arthur episode, And it's basically, I reel off a couple of the stanzas about... these warriors, and it's like one of the earliest ever mentions in Welsh, old Welsh poetry of King Arthur. So he's been about since fucking God knows when.
There's a good series at the moment with the guy from This Country, really funny guy, Charlie Cooper. He's doing British folklore, which apparently has such a massive revival at the moment. And the last episode is around King Arthur's treasure, and it's really funny, so I'd recommend it. It's on iPlayer, so go check that out. This is still a bit of a sidetrack, but this Owain Cyfeiliog, he also appears in a French romantic, or in like French romance literature. And there's a poem or a story about a chivalric knight where he strikes the lead of the... So where this Owain Cyfeiliog strikes the lead of this story with a spear. So he's famous enough to make it over to the French romantic scene. So maybe when we look at another episode. But back to Rhys, him and Owain finished their feud in Powys, and then both of them went on to besiege Norman Castle in Rhythland. In 1168, he attacked more Norman castles in Bilth, destroying their castles.
This guy's hobby is taking Norman castles.
30 years of just burning shit down. It's insane, man. But then, thankfully, due to the Norman invasion of Ireland in 1169, 1170, which was largely led by Cambro-Norman lords of South Wales. So, like, I'll tell you why in a minute. It's quite interesting, this. But Lord Rhys got some respite from this huge Norman forces, because, like, South Wales have been pretty much conquered by the Normans. They were so used to being in Wales, they were now classed as Cambro Norman, which means like Welsh Norman.
Mingled into it so much,
But apparently the Norman lords were prompted to go by a growing suspicion that King Henry did not intend to renew his offensive against the Welsh. Like, King Henry was like, I'm so fucking done with them that I'm not going to carry on.
Like you said, 30 years of this shit. You'd be like, oh, I can't be honest anymore. Like,
took a new policy of seeking accommodation with Welsh leaders. Okay. So thanks to Lord Rhys and Owain Gwynedd, who I would say personally are becoming my two most important Welsh leaders of all time.
It does pay to be a monumental pain in the ass. It pays off in the end.
Yeah. So they're like, right, we're not going to conquer any more lands in Wales. And Wales was like, just fucking hard work. So they're like, we'll go to Ireland. We're going to go conquer there instead. What's mad is that apparently the speculation that Lord Rees actually worked to distract the Norman lords by encouraging them to invade Ireland, which did them like this huge, he was like, he was really encouraging them to do this with huge enthusiasm. And they felt like Wales was no longer constant down all their castles and slaughtering their troops.
You can just imagine like some fucking banquet going, oh, probably best to do the Ireland now, isn't it? Do the Irish now, isn't it? Yeah. And they go, oh, because, you know, if you keep coming to me, I'm just going to keep burning
the
castles.
The shit out of you.
I'm just going to keep battering you.
The Normans, who had to rely on the Flemish and stuff, they lost a lot of morale because they kept having these defeats, like back-to-back defeats of castles burning.
And even like you say, when they go, right, we'll amass the fucking best of the best, they go, oh, it's raining, oh, I don't want to fight now because it's raining. You know, it's like, oh,
yeah,
fuck off. Guess what? It rains a lot in Wales, so maybe you don't want this country anyway.
Well, what's interesting, so when they did go to Ireland to start taking over there, King Henry II wasn't going to just accept his barons gaining territory and power in Ireland, so he claimed all their conquests as his own. And the apparent success of Rhys ap Gruffydd, Lord Rhys focused in the Norman attention to Ireland, proved to be a bit of a two-edged sword. As once the Normans eventually established a base in Dublin, they were now like a threat from both sides. So it wasn't just that. He convinced them to go. King Henry was like, you're not going and not fucking crediting me. So he let them go, but then in his honour, in his name, so he's still loyal to him.
Ah, and now you're like, yeah, they can come over from across the water and yeah. Mm.
But for a while, managed to keep Henry VII, make him like, Henry VII now saw him as, instead of it being like, oh, my policy is to attack you. My new policy is to have more cordial terms with you. And he stopped the Normans who were in Wales attacking him by sending them to Ireland. So in one move, he stopped the two biggest threats to Deheubarth and Wales.
That's like a running theme as well through Welsh history, is like we always take an opportunity. You know, it's like whenever you hear about like someone going, oh, they've pressed an advantage, it's usually when like England thinks, oh, the Welsh are subdued, wherever they go, let's have a fight in France, let's have a fight in Ireland, let's have a fight somewhere abroad. And they go, we'll send a big army over there. And then the Welsh go, right, let's have a fucking pop up now while the army's out of country. Yeah.
Well, this is interesting. In 1171, Henry II arrived in England after being in France to make his way to Ireland. Because Henry wished to establish an independent kingdom in Ireland because he couldn't trust those who'd been in Wales.
Yeah.
To be out now of his reach.
The Cambro-Normans, so now, mate, they were a bit of mixed now,
exactly,
weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. So he opted to try a different approach in his dealings with the Welsh and was influenced by the events going on in Ireland and his failed invasions. I can't take this guy for granted anymore. I can't keep fucking trying to like make him be a bit of a peasant to me and make him. I have to see him more as an equal. So he actually wished to make peace with Lord Rees, and he invited him to Newham to meet him, which is a town like in England, I think. I think it's like it's on the Severn, so I've never know. Yeah. The border changes, but it's kind of a halfway house between the two, from like Winchester to fucking West Wales. And he was like, let's make a peace, no longer a like treaty, but he was like, a part of this is, you know, you have your lands and you can keep all your lands you've taken from, which he classes his Norman lords, aka his lords, because the way the feudal system works, he's in charge of all of it. But for once, you can keep all of this stuff, which is fucking loads. Yeah. But you just got to give me 300 horses and 4,000 heads of cattle. So it's now more like a trade rather than a fucking subjugation. So they met again in October in Pembroke this time, whilst Henry waited to cross to Ireland. So they became so cordial that he could even have him in Wales, and there was no animosity. But also, he only gave him 86 of 300 horses. But Henry was like, fuck it, I'll only take
three. Such a Lord Rees thing to do.
well, like, horses were hard work. You know, they were, first of all, really expensive and really important against the Normans when they conquered England. One of the things the Normans used massively was horses. They used heavy horse to conquer most of it. And in Wales, the terrain was so difficult for horses that it wasn't really a thing we had. So it wasn't really something he could have in his retinue. But Henry II didn't care that much. He actually agreed to only take 36 of them. And he said, oh, I'll come back for the rest later. It wasn't even like shit, you 100. I'm not that ass. I'm only going to take 36. You can keep the other 50. And Rhys's son, Howell, who'd been held hostage for loads of years, was actually given back to him. And Henry and Rhys met once more at Larne when Henry came back from Ireland. And shortly after, Henry appointed Rhys justice on behalf of all of the Haybarth. So these like proper enemies had now become...
Finally, like giving him a bit of due respect kind of thing.
Yeah. And this is a quote from an actual clever clogs who knows a lot more about this stuff than I, a guy called A.D. Carr, who was a professor of medieval Welsh history at Bangor University. Hmm. He said, this title, so this on behalf of all the delegation to him of any authority which a king might have claimed over his fellow Welsh rulers, it might have involved some authority over the king's Anglo-Norman subjects. Rhys was more than a native Welsh ruler. He was one of the greatest feudatories of the Angevin Empire. So, like, he's given this Welsh ruler authority over the Anglo-Norman subjects who live in those areas. So there's quite a lot of English people.
Not just authority by proxy of being a Welsh ruler, but a Norman ruler has gone, yeah, you get that as well, with no qualms or anything. To think that he was trying to make him a vassal, you know, not that long ago, and then through sheer belligerence of Lord Rhys going, this ain't fucking happening, he just went, fine, you're justice of Deheubarth now, okay, mate?
It goes even madder. So this agreement between Henry and King Henry and Lord Rhys lasted all the way up until King Henry's death in 1189, which is fucking, like, this is a lot. In 1172, he made friends with them in Ireland, when he came back to Ireland. So they've been, like decent allies now for a while. So it's insane. Like, Lord Rhys had become an actual ally. When King Henry's sons rebelled against him in 1173, Rhys sent his own sons, Howell Sice, to Normandy to aid the king. And in 1174, he personally led an army to Tutbury in Staffordshire to assist the siege of stronghold of the rebel Earl, William de Ferres, to help King Henry. And then when Rhys returned to Wales after the fall of Tutbury, he sent 1,000 men to join the king for service in Normandy. Jeez. So, like, I think it's really important to remember, at one stage, young Lord Rhys, he was like fucking 14 years old, and he was like fighting from the ground up. Then he was about like 20, in his mid-20s. He got stripped of all of his lands and all of his castles and everything he went for, and was left with a measly cantref that was also being fed by the Normans. And he, like, you know, he had nothing. Mm. Now he's so powerful, the English king's asking him for help, and he sends 1,000 soldiers to protect him.
Make yourself indispensable, mate. That's what they say.
Well, King Henry held a council in Gloucester in 1175, which was attended by all the people who were in Wales, classing as a prince, but joined there by Lord Rhys. He was pretty much, you know, the main person in Wales. Mm. And it appears to have concluded the swearing of a mutual assistance pact for the preservation of peace and order in Wales. So, like, Henry II did awful, tried to attack Wales, failed, but then came to such respect for the leaders, was like, right, we're actually going to have a bit of stability here.
Yeah, a bit of mutual respect, yeah.
And then in 1177, Rhys Dafydd ap Owain, who'd emerged as the main powerhouse in Gwynedd, and Cadwallon ap Madog from Rhyngwyn a Hafren, swore fealty and liege homage to Henry at Council of Oxford. So they kept up this kind of, right, yes, you are the most powerful of this Isle of Great Britain, but there was like a peace to go there.
Hard earned by the sound of it as well, because like you said, like, you know, 30, 40 odd years of absolute tooth and nail fighting to get to that point of going, look, if you keep sidelining me, you keep fucking me over, I'm just going to keep fighting again and again. So why not?
Literally to that effect, the king, what you just said there, the king acknowledged that and gave, made the honour that is up in Gwynedd in North Wales, the king gave that to Rhys to like, kind of like, Haybarth gained, made the honour from Gwynedd.
That's mad. So Haybarth is like so south as well, like to have, like, I'm having. Up north as well.
Now we briefly leave the phase of him being a warrior prince, and now we focus on his artistic and cultural era, which is, I find, massively interesting now. Because he built this stability, he could like stop focusing on fucking war, because it's been going on for so long. And this is where I think he becomes more than some of the other leaders we've spoken about.
How old was
about.
He at this point now, just out of interest?
He's born in 1132, and this is 1175.
So that's a good 40, what's that, 43?
I don't know, can you do math?
43, so what was it, 1175 is what he is now, and 1132. 42, that's 40, 72. Yeah,
43. Yeah. So if you think he spent up until his like mid-30s fighting, and I mean literally from, you know,
yeah, like tooth and nail, yeah.
14 years old. He obviously been involved with the club, but his first record has been a part of an actual Welsh annal. Yeah. So he led his own private battle. He was leader of the battle in his early 20s, but he was first and in battles when he was 14 recorded, years old. Probably even younger than that. He was born in 1132. And then things calmed down. He literally spent his entire life fighting. So from his young age, he was running from battle to battle with his mum. And then he took over the ranks. So Matt, you know, me and you, 33, 34?
Yeah. We'd still, if we were him, we'd had another fucking, like,
got
what?
10 years of battle 10 years left.
On it, still to fight. Yeah. Fuck me.
And you spent the 30 years fighting. And also, the life expectancy of people at this time is so much younger. It's like 28, I think, at the time.
Mm.
So, like, he's just spent such a long time fighting. But because he's now, one of the first times he's actually caused peace in all of Wales, he focused on other aspects of William. So, like, it's not since, like, King actually start building on the creativity and, like, the other aspects.
Yeah, turning into something other than just war all the time. Yeah.
So he's credited being the very first Welsh leader ever to build a native castle made of stone in Wales. Because, like, all the other ones have been built of wood and stuff like that. So all of the castles in Wales, all of the stone castles in Wales were non-native. There's a great account called Welsh Histories on Instagram and Facebook that will just go through all the castles in Wales and say when they're built, if they're native or non-native, who looks after them, and a bit of history about them.
Because a lot of what people don't seem to realise, although Wales has more, you know, more castles per square mile or whatever than anywhere else in the world, a lot of those were
built, actually, a bad fact.
Yeah, were built by English or Norman. Yeah.
Well, it's a subjugatory tool.
It's to subdue the Welsh, because we were so
constantly
fucking rebelling. They built castles everywhere as strongholds to keep us sort of oppressed.
I mean, it's impressive in the sense that, well, that's how much of a thorn on the side we were, but they weren't built by us. Like, nearly all the castles were built by invaders and their foreign castles. Because he now had enough time to, like, consider things, and stone castles were so much more expensive. So when he built Cardigan Castle out of stone, it's considered the first truly Welsh, truly Welsh stone castle, which is really cool, isn't it? He also built Carrig Kennan Castle near Llandeilo, which is one of the best.
That's a
you know that one. It's so cool, man. It's on this amazing mountaintop where you can see all of Llandeilo. It's awesome. It's really, really, really cool. Interestingly as well, man, he got as the creator of the Eisteddfod.
Legitimize like the bardic profession or something like that, was it? I'm confusing him with someone else.
He funded all that stuff, so he was the creator of the first National Eisteddfod, but it was a festival of poetry and song at his court in Caradigion Castle over Nadolig, so over Christmas in 1176. So he was right, we don't have to keep fighting, and we are a nation of singers and storytellers. That's what we're going to go back to doing. And this festival was announced a year in advance throughout all of Wales, England, Scotland, Ireland, and France. And he made these two great chairs as prizes, one for the best poem and one for the best musical performance.
Oh, mate, that's clever.
And now he's now back to doing what Wales can do if we're not getting fucking harassed. And a historian called R.R. Davis suggests that the texts of Welsh law, traditionally codified by Hywel at Whitland, were then first introduced in book form under Lord Rees. So he was like, right, we have these laws, but now I'm going to actually codify it properly in a book form.
Yeah.
And it shows when Wales is allowed to govern itself, it can build these stunning feats of engineering, these beautiful castles, and these also harbour creativity and festivals that celebrate art and poetry and life and love and all this stuff. Stuart Lee, that comedian, recently said that this government needs to not just get people working, but be able to have interests and hobbies so that, often we're just literally working to survive. The shit show of the Tories and all the stuff the last 20 years. Me and you, mate, so bad.
How often do we go on about I literally just work so I have enough money to enjoy my life. You know, I hate that it's that way around.
Exactly. And none of us have, barely anyone has savings and all this stuff. Like, you know, it's, and we're lucky that we don't have children, so we make time to do this podcast. But how often would people want to do something they care about, or like do more painting, do more things for their family? And that's what government should do. They should make sure you're not just fucking working for a living. And it resonated when I saw that, because I saw that quote whilst I was researching all this stuff about Lord Rees. And I feel that's what happened when Lord Rees ruled. So maybe we go back to like a medieval style leadership. But he brought in this, like, all right, we're stopping these wars for like a good period. And he brings in this medieval style, or this like, you know, artistic.
Yeah, a creative kind of creativity. Wales, like, yeah.
Which we haven't covered an awful lot, because so often when we cover stuff, it's like we're being battered.
Because we love the battles, don't we? Yeah, that's
it. Yeah. But yeah, maybe we need him. I bet you even his government was more progressive than the Tories. Am I right?
Am I right, bro?
Lord Rees also founded two religious houses during this period, the Tully Abbey, the first Premonsterian Abbey in Wales. Don't know what that means, didn't read it up. While Llanllyd was only the second nunnery to be founded in Wales and the first one to actually prosper. So he built Llanllyd, which was a nunnery, and he also built this Premonsterian, probably for a monasterian thing. I don't know what that is. But
he's a man of many layers. He wasn't, like, even though he was very much this warrior boy.
He
had something else to him.
This patron of the island and Strata Florida, which Strata Florida is like the most important site in Wales for many people, because it's where, like, mate, some of the best, you know, I think Llywelyn Llyw was buried. No, Llywelyn Vawr might have been buried there, as family say. You know, it's a really, really pivotal part of, like, and also he gave these huge grants to both of these abbeys to be built. So usually, like, you know, Wales didn't have, it wasn't prosperous before. And he through his, like, battles, his heart, but also the way he negotiated, the way he demanded respect from a really powerful enemy, allowed Wales to prosper. And Giraldus Cambrenis.
I hate to distill everything we do down to a Braveheart quote, but to paraphrase, he fought like a warrior poet.
He actually was warrior poet, which is mad. Yeah. Giraldus Cambrenis, or Gerald of Wales, who's this historian of the day, travelled all of Wales to write about his history.
He fucking made so many guest appearances on this pod, didn't he? Everything you talk about, he has a little fucking 2p to say about.
He was related to Rees, and he gives an account of meeting Lord Rees in 1188. So this is a long time. Lord Rees has been, it's quite a quiet time in terms of battle, and he's been a bit older. And Giraldus accompanied Archbishop Baldwin around Wales to try to raise men for the Third Crusade, which I think will be interesting, because at this period there was peace between Wales and England. The archbishops of England could come to Wales and ask for their soldiers to go fight in the crusade. Yeah. And some of the Welsh clerics were really, they were like, no, it's for country. Don't. So the soldiers stopped fighting, but the clerics started fighting.
The clerics started getting rowdy.
But it was a generally crazy thing that this could happen between these two warring countries, that you could actually have this kind of lack of animosity. And Lord Rees was really enthusiastic. Gave the bishop this huge deal of assistance and greeted him really well. He was like, right, you think I am as equal as a king of England? This is fucking brilliant. And Gerald of Wales said that Rees decided to go on the crusade himself and spent several weeks making preparations. He's like, I have been out of the game too long. I'm off to go fight.
I'm going to blow dust off the old cobwebs, get my fucking sword on.
Although eventually he's persuaded to change his mind by his wife, also quote, Gwenllian, due to her female artifices, which I think mentioned, which made him took sense into him. It's like, listen, you're old as fuck. Just enjoy the fact that
you're going to die if you go over there. Yeah. Also, you're used to the Welsh weather. It's hot as fuck over where they're doing the Crusades, so don't even bother.
Well, he didn't have to wait too long, because 1189, after years and years of peace due to the treaty agreement with Henry II, Rees was back to his fighting ways. That's because Henry II died, and Rees believed he was no longer bound by the peace treaty, and he set about attacking the Norman lordships around his territory. So Wales was still had Norman influence, but Deheubarth had been set up, Gwynedd was fine. So he was like, yeah, right.
If anything, and he wouldn't was attack. Okay. He could have just led his life and been fine, I imagine. Yeah.
But yeah, I just picture him for all these years of peace, just fucking fuming. So then he went, because all the places around him still had Norman influence. He's really anti it.
His missus going, well, you said I couldn't go to the Crusades, so now I got to do this, all right? You should have let me go, because then I could have got it out of my system.
Well, look what he did. He then fucking ravaged Pembroke, Hereford West, the Galway, captured castles in St. Clair's, Lange, San Stefan, and he just burned everything to ground again.
He was in the mirror after all these going, still got it, still got it.
And now, the king, so you know, like King Richard, the guy who went off to the crusade, his brother, Prince John, later King John. So his Prince John came to, so when the crusade was going on, Prince John came to Wales in September to try and make peace because he was literally like, fucking hell, you're mental. So he came all the way over to Wales, and it shows the immense influence and power Lord Rees has. And he persuaded Rees to raise the siege of Carmarthen and accompany instead to Oxford to meet King Richard. He said, discovered Richard was not prepared to travel to meet him there. So then he's like, well, fuck you. If you're not going to come all the way to meet me, and I've traveled all the way from West Wales, you can get fucked. Yeah. So then he felt scorned. He's like, fuck this. I'm going to burn everything down. And so then he went back and he carried on his attitude that he had done. Although in the later parts of his year, Lord Rees had a massive trouble keeping his sons under control. So particularly Maelgwyn and Griffiths, they had that fire in them that their father and grandparents had. And they kept like fighting with each other and stuff. And the son, Griffiths, is also said to have persuaded his father to annex the lordship of Cemmaes, Dyfed, and its chief castle of Nefrin, which was held by a Norman, William Fitzmartin. And then 1191, the action was criticised by Gerald Wales, which described Griffiths to be quite cunning and artful. He's slightly taking advantage of his dad. Fitzmartin was married to Rhys's daughter, Angharad, and according to Gerald, Rhys previously had solemnly sworn by the pressure and security that he'd never be like attacked. So it made Rhys look a bit like he was not being very honourable, and his words no longer his bond, because he listened to his son and he like imprisoned this man who he'd already said he would be protected. And also Lord Rhys for decades had been made this like really honourable figure.
Very honourable gent. Yeah.
But Lord Rhys was now, like, he annexed loads of the Norman lordships of Cadwelly and Carnarvon in 1190. And then 1192.
It's all gone a bit pear-shaped by this point.
Well, it's just like his sound mind's going a little bit, but he's still a fucking great warrior. And 1192, Rhys secured Maelgwyn's release, his son, who he had, let Griffiths like a. In prison.
I'll let you out of prison now. Yeah.
Yeah. But he was trying to like stop these two sons arguing, but it just didn't happen and they became massive.
I was about to say, I imagine Maelgwyn probably was a little bit resentful about being
Funny you say that. Maelgwyn then attacked Lord Rees, who by this stage is in his 60s, with another man called Howell, and imprisoned Lord Rees in Nevern Castle. They later released him, and Maelgwyn never consented to this, but he was really pissed off about it. But like, it shows that he's starting to lose his grip on around there, and it's mostly the grip is coming from his family because he's quite family orientated. And
I was going to say, it seems as though that family values that was instilled in him from his mum and dad hasn't really passed down, has it?
But it stayed with him, but it didn't pass down to his sons. And Gerald Royal suggests that Rhys's incarnation in Nevern Castle was divine vengeance for his disposition of William Fitzmartin. So you know I said like he promised to not never attack William because he listened to his sons. It was like divine intervention that
he karma, baby. Be
And then in 1195, his two other sons, Rhys Grigg and Meredith, they seize Llan Dinevor and responded by imprisoning them. And then Rhys launched his last campaign against the Normans in 1196, and he captured a bunch of castles again, including Carmarthen, Colwyn, Radnor, Payne's Castle.
If you bring Lord Rhys to a castle capturing party, you can guarantee he's going to get some.
Well, I'll say him again. Carnarvon, Colwyn, Radnor, Payne's Castle. Then he had defeated armies led by Roger de Mortimer, Hugh de Seynod, and someone else in Radnor, and 40 highly skilled and experienced knights, so like the best of the best, were all left dead. By Lord Rhys again.
De Mortimer is another one that's fucking always sticking their bloody beak into Wales, isn't it? Mortimer and de Grey, they're always a bloody self. Don't even get me
started. This became, it was like a, it was a really big battle, but it was also his last battle. William de Brosset and people, they offered these terms and stuff, and they like...
Yeah, the old goat still got something in him. Yeah.
In 1197, Rhys died 28th of April, and it wasn't like he died in battle. It was unexpected. Mm. There was apparently great pestilence throughout the island of Britain, and that tempest killed innumerable people, and many of the nobility, and many princes, and spared nobody. That year, 4 days before May Day, died Rhys ap Gruffydd, Prince of the Haybarth, and unconquered head of all Wales, which is such a cool title to be given.
Cool.
He was buried at St. David's Cathedral, and his statue looks fucking stupid. It's so annoying when you Google it. There's like some stupid like lion or like dog looking behind him. If you Google
his statue.
Yeah, the photo is so stupid.
What the it's fuck like is he's that
got,
behind
he's
him?
Got little...
He looks like a gnome. He looks like a gnome. And something behind him looks like a kind of pig dog.
Because
with like one wing.
He's got this little going, it's so stupid. But Jack, you know me and you want to do another road trip, and we are debating doing Brittany. We're thinking maybe Brittany. I really think we should go to St. David's Cathedral, because it's meant to be fucking class.
Yeah,
and I really want to go visit Rhys ap Gruffydd, because he's like, they buried him there out of like, you know, he was so well respected. Eldest. So he nominated his eldest legitimate son, Gruffydd ap Rhys.
He wasn't going to do Cyfran or whatever it was.
And soon after his father's death, Gruffydd met the Justiciar, Archbishop Hubert Walter, on the border and was confirmed as the heir. However, Maelgwyn, the eldest son, illegitimate, refused to accept this and was given military assistance by Gwenwynin ap Owain of Powys.
And then Maelgwyn, he's a bad boy.
Yeah, we've done it, haven't we?
Isn't his whole line like a fucking the turncoats, aren't they?
He's trying to like his
family fought against Llywelyn ap Gruffydd as well, didn't they?
Well, we've had a few things with the
Gwenwynins also. Gwenwynin in Welsh, Gwenwyn is poison. Gwenwynin is wasp, isn't it?
I don't know if it comes from this, but it feels like he's been named that. Those words have come post this man.
Yeah, it feels like there's something there, though, isn't it? It's like coincidence. I think not.
Yeah. So Maelgwyn, this oldest son but illegitimate, took then the castles and towns of Aberystwyth, captured Gruffydd, the oldest son, whom he handed over to the custody of Gwenwynin. Gwenwynin later handed over to the king and imprisoned him at Corfe Castle. And this is a classic tale of not having a strong successor who could unite all. And the Welsh ability to fight their own shadows, all this stuff. And like, as soon as it was like, this is so Welsh. And after this, they hate you apart. That due to the work of Rhys and his ability to fiercely defend West Wales, likely that hit Mike Cornwall. So, you know, like not quite English, but no longer an independent kingdom or like this. So the people offer, like history say, had top in there. This part of Wales would just, it would have really fucked up Wales. You'd have North Wales.
Own thing, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll end by summing up how Lord Rhys was remembered by Gerald of Wales, who said he was a man of excellent wit and quick in repartee. And Gerald tells his story at a banquet in Hereford, 1186, where Rhys was sat between two members of the De Clare family. Now, this was going to be really tense and antagonistic, because Rhys literally seized their land.
As we know, the De Clare's a bastard.
But it's the other way around. Lord Rhys had seized their land and carried it previously held by them. So, like, he'd literally conquered their land and he was sat next to them. And they were like, you're a cunt.
Want to come to a party, De Clare? So you want to sit down at my table?
Apparently, due to the charm of Rhys, the night that was full of, it was meant to be like, they were like, oh shit, this is going to be so awkward. And he sat, as he was, the night was full of courteous compliments by Rhys and good humoured ribbing, followed by some banter between Rhys and Gerald about their family connections. And like, he kind of like, it summed him up. Like, he was sitting by men whose lands he'd literally taken back and, in their eyes, stolen. And there was no animosity because he was really funny about it.
I'd love to go for a pint
He's the guy you want to
Lord Rhys. Hello.
There's also another contemporary writer who wrote of Rhys, although he's given a pseudonym. This writer didn't like Rhys, but he still had something nice to say about him. So this guy who didn't like Lord Rhys still said something. He writes, "This king I have seen and known, and I hate." But goes on to say, "I would not have hatred blacken his worth. It is not my wish ever to suppress any man's excellence through envy." So like he said, like, this guy who I hate, but just because I hate him, I shouldn't downplay it.
Doesn't mean he's not shit.
Yeah. He goes on to say, this same man gave provisions to his enemies when besieged and driven by risk of famine to capitulate. So, like, if there are people who were starving, he would still feed them. He wished to overcome them by his own strength and not by want of bread. So he was like, I'm not going to fucking starve you out of here. That doesn't make me look strong. But, like, I'm going to show you by my own strength that you will give up. So he deferred victory, but increased his own renown through it. So, like, he didn't, he'd rather not, like, have you out. He's like, no, that's not a brave man, that's not a strong man.
Rather siege you out sort of thing. He'd rather conquer it outright.
Conquer it, yeah. And then you'd be like, shit, this guy doesn't care, he's strong. So, he that kind of speaks to the merit of the person. And finally, that victory was indeed a remarkable one. It's very dense with a tribute. Occupied the stage of Welsh politics for over 50 years. And from his first appearance in his early teens at the capture of Llansteffan Castle in 1146 to his death in 1197, it is his achievement which was astounding. He had reconstituted the kingdom of Heybarth and made it the premier Welsh kingdom. For once, the poet's compliment was well deserved. Rhys had restored the majesty of the south, which is, you know, praise on high. And although many know that there's two flaws in Rhys's leadership, one was his personal nature of his accord with Henry II, like, because he was so belligerent to him. But in my point, that's a good thing. But it meant he didn't survive. What was really bad is, like, because they had such bad relationships for so long, the minute he died, he didn't respect anyone else's retinue. So that's when he attacked all those other places. Like, had he been more cordial with him, that would have passed down to the next part of it. But it was like, no, we have a peace in place, but the minute you're dead, I'm going to fuck up everyone around you.
Well, yeah. Who was it? And I'm showing my fucking amateur nature here. Who was it who was regarded as a Prince of Wales by the King of England? Was it Hothar or was it?
No, so Llywelyn the Great.
Was it Llywelyn the Great, maybe, who was like had a good relationship with the king?
Well, yeah. So he married the king's daughter, Joan.
That's right. And yeah, so he had, and that then was like it set up a that actually went the wrong way, in that when his son then became the King of England's son became king, he was fuming that Edward the Welsh had had so much power. It was Edward the First. He was fuming that he had so much power. But, like, I know what you mean in that it's.
Well, because historians take saying, like, had he made a better, more peaceful nature, he would have had when the succession followed.
Because as entertaining as it is, and as much as I love this story, the fact that Lord Rhys got so much respect is because he had to just be a belligerent arsehole all the way through to get that. So, of course, when he died, I can totally see, like, the English crown or, you know, any sort of opposing force thinking, well, whatever we had with him doesn't stand anymore.
And also, if he's already been, like, taken prisoner and his son's been blinded and all these things, he has that hatred still within him. And also, so that's the first thing that they often think there's two flaws in his leadership. So his inability to have this cordial relationship. I actually think that's not a flaw. That's completely valid. But the other was his inability to control his sons or to force them to accept Griffiths as his successor. Had they built Griffiths?
From what you've said, that sounds like a real, like, towards the end of his life, definitely. That sort of fucked him a bit.
But and he's widely regarded as the best leader Wales has ever seen. And classic this pod, not many people know about Lord Rhys. I mean, yes, historians do, but I reckon a good percentage of our fans who enjoy this, or not fans, or listeners to this, will agree that, like, wow, we should know more about him. He should be in our school. We should learn about him, not fucking Henry II.
He seems like more influential. I know this is probably blasphemous in the Welsh history scene, but more influential than, like, certainly Glyndŵr, maybe not Llywelyn.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know.
Llywelyn also he's fought for decades
as well. I think people
care
a lot about Llywelyn Llywelyn because he was the last one. But he wasn't the most successful.
Not a press.
And I love him to bits.
But certainly Glyndŵr. Certainly outranks Glyndŵr, I think, in terms of
I think a lot of people don't love Glyndŵr. I think lots of us start feeling like, oh, and Glyndŵr is probably still really important, but I think when you read other ones, he's got great PR team. There'd be a pub called the Lord Rhys, you know what I mean? Like, not just the Glyndŵr.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, the father of the Eisteddfod. But anyway, Dylan Grandar, I really enjoyed learning this one. I hope you enjoyed hearing it.
Oh, mate, That was so good. Yeah, I know. I can see why you're saying like he's risen up the ranks in your favorite Welsh rulers, because that's
he deserves a two-parter, didn't he? I think that's fair to give him a two-parter. 100%. All right, mate. Diolch yn grando, guys. Thanks for joining me.
Ta-na.
Ta-na. Until next week. Ta-na.